Hello, and welcome to the Slomcast, episode 6, for June 8th, 2010. Today is another special day for the podcast. Not only do I have one guest here, but I have two guests. First guest, you remember him from last week, Ryan Lancey.
Hey everyone, how are you doing?
And second guest, you do not remember him from last week, is Frank Cameron. Say hi, Frank.
Hello.
Okay, that was Frank. That was good. All right, so got a lot of stuff to talk about this week. The important stuff is going to come at the end, so you're just going to have to wait for that. You know, I guess important for me, because I think it's important. But the first thing we want to start off with is something that a rather large company did that is kind of crappy if they did it on purpose, but they say that they didn't do it on purpose. So some of you probably heard that as Google drives around with their Google Maps car with the camera, getting all of the pictures for Google Street View, that over in Germany, they also happen to be collecting public Wi-Fi data. Now, all they really wanted to collect was the SSID, so the name of the network, and the MAC address of the access point. They didn't really say what they used it for. Do you guys know, like, they wanted to use it in their location services, like Google Latitude, things like that? Do you know any more than that?
Actually, I think what I read is that Google didn't even intend to capture the data.
Well, they wanted to get the SSID and the MAC, but they didn't want traffic. Like, do you know, Frank?
You're right. So based on the SSID and the MACs, if you were on a computer that didn't have a GPS device, for example, your laptop, and hooked up to the location-based services, it would send what access points it sees to Google so they could estimate your location even though you didn't have GPS.
Okay, so it was just for location estimation. It wasn't what I thought they were doing was like you were going somewhere and then Google's map service would say, hey, if you want free internet, here's a list of open networks in your area, which would kind of be cool. But I guess that wasn't their intention.
Modern day war driving.
Exactly, except yes. Google's doing it for us.
I think there's a service called Skyhook that actually provides some of the same things that, you know, is like location based on the MAC address of the router you're connected to.
I never heard of Skyhook. Yeah.
You can actually manually add your own router to Skyhook.
Oh,
and
okay.
I believe there was a plugin for the really early Google beta, Google Maps beta on Windows Mobile years ago, that would use the Skyhook data. Well, not years ago, probably a year ago.
It was so long ago.
Like 10 years in technology years, though.
Right.
You know how that works.
I was a baby. Yeah, but the problem was that, okay, so here's what happened. So Google likes to reuse code. They didn't want to have to rewrite code for their Street View car so that they could go around and collect these public wireless SSIDs and MAC addresses. So they already had an in-house project that did that plus more. So they just took the code, you know, copy-paste, took the code that they wanted that they thought would get the job done, put it on their new application for their Street View car, and went around. What they didn't realize was that that code also samples traffic from those networks. So what could have happened is if somebody was, you know, buying from Amazon and submitting their credit card at the time the Google Street View car passed around, they could have captured the packets with people's credit card information. We don't know if that happened, but that's possible because they were actually grabbing data. So Google says they didn't do this on purpose. It was a mistake. They didn't know that the piece of code they copied and pasted actually did that. What do you guys think? You know, bad for Google.
Yeah, it's bad. At this point, I'm willing to give them the benefit of the doubt at this point that it was not intentional and they're not going to do it intentionally anymore. Hopefully not anymore.
Right.
But
it seems like
it was all
enough.
You know, open, unencrypted data they were collecting. So,
yes. I mean, step one, everybody who was using that, they were probably dumb enough and didn't realize that they were using public. They didn't, you know, they might just be normal users who don't understand what it means to have encrypted data. So, you know, boo on them. But yeah, I think Google's done enough good for the world that you can forgive them on this accident.
Yeah, I think as far as, I don't know about the other countries like Germany, and I think Australia was the other one that's looking into it now. But in the United States, you're allowed to, any airwaves that come on that you receive, you're allowed to intercept and read, but the only rule is you can't divulge those to anyone else.
Oh, okay.
So I don't know that they've actually done anything wrong, like, or they would have done anything wrong in the United States, but I don't know about Germany's laws.
Yeah, as far as the laws in Germany, I don't think anything has happened with it yet, but the law enforcement in Germany said, okay, you give us the data you collected, you tell us what you did, and we will decide which laws in Germany you broke. So they're actually looking into it to see if, you know, Google did break German law doing this. Hopefully they didn't, or if they did, they're not going to hurt them, because I like Google. I don't want to see Google go away.
Great company.
Okay, so next topic is something that a lot of Xbox users have probably heard about for a while. Project Natal, or Natal, as some people say. I think it comes from Latin. The definition means of or relating to birth, which Microsoft says it's the birth of the next generation of home entertainment. So for those people who don't know what Natal is, basically it's a remote control for your gaming system without the remote control. So it tracks your hand movements. You pretend you have a remote in your hand. You pretend you're driving a car, and it tracks your movements, 48 skeletal points on your body, and tries to figure out what you're doing to control the game. Have you guys heard anything other than, you know, what this does?
Well, when it was originally announced, like, last year or whatever, seen it then, haven't really seen much lately. The demo at the time and some of the demos I've since then seen seem kind of lame, but we'll see.
Yeah, it seems gimmicky so far. Have you seen any, Ryan?
Well, I watched the recent D8 conference, or some of the videos from it, and they had a demo by some PR representative from Microsoft, which was probably a mistake. But the technology, I think, is very promising. I don't know how much of the research that's gone into Project Natal, that how much of it is Microsoft's own research, but I think in the same way that multi-touch interfaces have started to revolutionize how we interact with computers, the 3D motion detection for humans without a controller on your body, you know, the Wii has some of this, you know.
Yeah, you still need a controller, but
right, you got to hold a controller, and there's other, you know, there's aspects to it, but you know, seeing the demo that they did, and specifically with the PR representatives, or actually, I think it was one of the D8 interviewers' children that came out. Their son had come out to do the demo, and the actual interaction with the Xbox. It was impressive that he caught on so quickly and was able to, like, learn the interface. And I'm sure they practiced, but I noticed that it seemed like the adults didn't have anywhere near the hand-eye coordination that he was immediately able to attribute to this new technology.
Yeah, that's kind of funny. It seems that way with any device. Like, you give them an iPhone or any new device, and it's like, oh, I don't know what to do with this.
Yeah.
You know, whereas kids just go for it.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, it brings back memories of when I watched Minority Report, and I think that's everybody probably really compares this with, you know.
Right.
If no one's familiar with that movie, I don't know how you can be if you're listening to this podcast, but
never seen it.
Oh, Frank!
Oh, no. Oh. Oh, no. He just outed himself.
Okay, we're going to pause the podcast right now and go watch Minority Report.
Yeah.
No, okay.
It's either that or Frank has to leave, one of the two. No, anyways, I really think that, you know, this, that you know, we watched, when I watched the movie the first time and saw, you know, Tom Cruise, he's moving these things or objects around on the screen with his hands, it's amazing. You know, it's how we want to interact with computers. And I think for many areas that Steve Jobs is wrong in, one he's right in is that the multi-touch interface brings you closer to the PC. It's a more interactive experience, and I think this is the next step in that type of technology.
Right. So have both of you played the Wii? You're familiar, yeah, with how the Wii works with their thing?
Yeah.
So I just think, like, when I'm playing a video game, I like to be able to hold something. You know, I don't know how much I'm going to like, you know, doing a driving game where I don't have a wheel to hold. You know, my hands are just kind of floating in the air. Or if, you know, you're playing a sword fighting game, you don't actually have a sword to hold. Your hands are just kind of flopping in the air. Like, how do you guys think that'll work with gameplay that you don't actually have an object to hold on to?
I mean, honestly, just grab whatever's in the room. If you want to hold a steering wheel, grab an inanimate steering wheel that is just, you know...
Go rip the steering wheel out of your car.
Yeah, it just has to be a circular device. Go grab a plate out of the cupboard. It really doesn't matter at that point, because it can still detect... If you need the feel of the plate, or of the steering wheel, or in the instance of a sword, you know, you grab, like, a stick or something, you know, something... Of similar shape and size. A broom, yeah, you know. If you need that, then you can still do that. It does to the game that it makes a difference.
Yeah, I wonder if they're going to do like what Nintendo did and start coming out with gimmicks. Like, you know, for Star Wars, they came out with lightsabers, which are actually just pieces of plastic that attach onto the Wii remote to make you feel like you're holding a lightsaber. You know, I wonder if Microsoft is going to start putting out these things for Natal just to give people that feel.
Yeah, I don't doubt the gimmicks are coming. Although I do agree that going forward, this type of, you know, immersive environment where the computer is seeing you and reacting with you is definitely going to be growing in the future.
Yeah,
I'm hoping Minority Report happens now.
If you know, if you're like me and you want a holodeck, this is the first step.
Yes.
So any movement in that direction is really cool.
And, you know, all information out there, I really never watched Star Trek, so I saw a holodeck for the first time like 2 nights ago when I stayed up too late watching Star Trek, so I got that reference.
Now we're going to have to ask Kevin to leave.
Okay, so Sloncast is over. We will never record another episode. So for those of you wondering about Project Natal, it's scheduled to have its... premiere. I don't know if it's a release premiere or if it's just like the first public premiere, but June 13th, it's at a pre-party to E3, the big video game conference. That's when Project Natal is set to premiere. I don't know what they mean by premiere, because like Ryan just said, you've seen it at D8. It's been talked about for the past year, like Frank said, you know, I don't know what premiere means, but it's coming out, air quotes, can't see them, but it's coming out on June 13th. So moving right along, anyone who knows me knows that I hate Adobe, so I had to get this story in here. It wasn't really a big story, but it was one that kind of caught my eye. So if any of you use Adobe products, you know, Flash, Adobe Acrobat, Adobe Reader, those ones are the ones that you see it a lot in, you probably know that every week you get a pop-up, hey, upgrade to the, you know, version 9.0.13725 of Adobe Reader. And then next week you get another one. So every time this happens, it's probably because of, you know, some vulnerability or something they patched. But recently, with Adobe's Acrobat and Reader products, they've started integrating Flash. So Flash, if you don't know, it's the online plugin that you use in your web browser, you know, YouTube. If you ever watch a YouTube video, you use Flash. And there's a vulnerability in Flash that allows hackers to remotely execute code, which if you are a good enough hacker, that means that they can execute code which will give them control of your computer. So that's nothing new. Lots of programs have remote code execution. But what I thought was interesting is that now that Flash has been embedded in Adobe Reader or Adobe Acrobat, now everybody who has upgraded to the newest version of Adobe Acrobat and Reader is now vulnerable to this. Because of Flash. So what do you guys think of that? A, just, you know, them incorporating Flash into Reader and Acrobat, why is that really needed? And what do you think about the vulnerability?
Well, I mean, it seems to me that this kind of stuff is, you know, just the cost of doing business on the internet. You got, you know, a lot of people that are coding applications out there, and if it's a one that provides some sort of API or especially if there's some kind of hole, it can be very very damaging. But that said, I just don't think that there's really much we can do to avoid it going forward. You know, we just have to I think, you know, the fact that the companies even release patches, we're lucky they do that, to be quite honest.
Right.
So
yeah, what do you guys think in terms of just having Flash integrated in Acrobat in the first place? Do you see a reason why that's even needed?
None of the PDFs I've interacted with have needed something like that. I really haven't even used many where the JavaScript that's been in there for a while and source of many previous vulnerabilities has been necessary. But most of my documents are purely static. I don't do a lot of business form type stuff.
Yeah, I've never seen a PDF that has had plugins, let alone even JavaScript.
Mm-hmm.
So,
I guess it's one of those things, you know, just depends on your needs. Maybe Adobe has plans to move forward with Reader in a different way. Who knows? It could be that they're integrating technologies together to, you know, because they're just for the sake of integrating, then that they're using the same back-end code or something else. But
right.
The one use case for the JavaScript was in your PDF form, similar to a web page, it would do form validation as you fill it out.
That's actually a good idea.
But I've never encountered a document that's actually used that.
One use case for Flash would be that the document could contain instructions on how to fill it out.
So you mean like voice instructions or, you know, pointing hands or something interactive.
Yeah. Or a video, right?
Or a video.
The Flash could store a video, right? You know, the Flash code could store some sort of
video. Actually not a bad idea, especially for tax forms and other things like that.
I was just thinking
like
that. Same thing. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, all these problems, you know, I've hated Adobe Reader just because it's bulky. You know, to read a PDF, you don't need a 100 megabyte program to do that job. So I always tell people, you know, use Foxit Reader, which is free for anybody on Windows. You know, it does the same thing as Adobe. Or if you have a Mac, Preview, you know, built into Mac, hit the space bar, and it brings up the PDF. You know, so I always tell people to use other things. But I did run into problems with form fields. So certain PDFs that have editable form fields that you can fill out within Adobe Acrobat or within your reader, some of those don't work in the other programs like Foxit or Preview or anything. So, yeah, switch to another program. You might get rid of the vulnerabilities, but if you fill out a lot of PDFs, you might also lose that functionality. So, I don't know. I guess this is just the case of, you know, be careful when you use PDFs. You know, don't download things. I don't know. It sounds so simple to us, you know, but I see a lot of people, you know, at work and other places that just randomly click yes to everything, and you just want to punch them in the face. So, I don't know. You guys have any last thoughts on that?
The one thing I just note, I think the vulnerability existed in a previous version of Flash. The most current version of Flash does not have the vulnerability yet.
That's good to know. At least they're patching it.
Well, it's the most current release version is vulnerable. The pre-release of 10.1 isn't vulnerable, but it hasn't actually hit full release yet.
So nobody has it then?
Yeah.
I do.
Oh. Well, of course you do.
On the plus side, Flash 10.1 also has hardware decoding support for H.264 video. Ooh. On Mac OS.
Ooh. Plus one for Mac. All right.
I think they may have already had it in Windows version.
Windows had it last year. That's
crap. Minus two for Mac. Okay, so moving on. So getting into the meat of the show now. So just a couple days ago, is it still going on, the D conference, or was it over last week?
I think it's over.
Okay, so the D conference is the All Things Digital conference put on by the Wall Street Journal. Two of their employees, one of them you might have heard, Walt Mossberg, and the other one, Kara Swisher. Basically, it's, you know, from what you can see on the internet and all the videos, it's a conference where they do interviews. You know, Walt and Kara interview hard-hitting people in the technology realm. So there are three large reddish-orange chairs on a stage. You know, Walt and Kara take one, and the other one is filled by somebody. You know, guests this year were, you know, Steve Ballmer, Steve Jobs, Mark Zuckerberg. So a lot of heavy-hitting CEOs, you know, people who make decisions in technology are interviewed. And one thing that is different about this conference compared to other interviews is that Walt and Kara ask the tough questions. You know, if there's something that's on people's minds, you know, everybody's thinking, oh, you know, Steve Jobs, why did you do this? That was a stupid move. Nobody ever asked them that. But Walt and Kara asked them that. You know, they called everybody out in these interviews. So what do you think, Ryan? I can see you're ready to...
Well, I'd say that I think the key point is that they ask a couple hard-hitting questions and then a whole lot of dumb ones.
That is true.
The interviewing skills, I just have to make a comment. Watching some of the interviews is painful when the interviewer isn't educated on some of the topics. And I'd say that's... maybe not the, you know, it may not be all the time, but it's a large percentage. But all in all, I think the interviews are good. You know, they're informative and they're interesting for the most part.
So I know I watched some of the videos. Frank, did you see any of them?
No, I haven't had much of a chance to sit down and watch these yet.
Okay, so you can give us the outsider's perspective on these. And I know Ryan watched some of them.
Yeah, I got to see the parts of the interview. Initially, they only released short 3-minute clips of most of the interviews. And there's probably 3 or 4 clips from the interview with Mark Zuckerberg. Wait, is that his name?
Yeah, Zuckerberg.
Yeah, Zuckerberg. And it was interesting to watch him completely crumble on stage under the pressure of...
Hilarious.
Walt and Kara. But, you know, the other interviews... I watched a large portion of the interview with Steve Jobs, and it's interesting, you know, to hear. I mean, regardless of whether like you like his equipment or his methods or anything else, it's interesting just to hear his take on things.
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting. You know, everybody always, you know, says, you know, Steve doesn't know what the people want, or they're always saying negative things about him because a lot of people just don't like the Mac products or the Apple products. But hearing him talk, you can really understand that. He's really just trying to make stuff that he thinks people will like. You know, there's no evilness behind it. He's not trying to make billions. He's already done that 30 times over. You know, he's really just trying to make stuff that people like. Frank, I know you are a big Mac user. You know, what do you think in terms of what you think Steve is trying to accomplish?
I don't think I disagree with what you just said there. I have the impression that he's honestly trying to make good products that people like. So I don't know if I'd call myself a big Mac user.
Well,
but
compared to some of the other people that we know, you're one of the few people who use Macs. So you're big in that term.
Yeah, the I think one of the most interesting interviews that I'd seen from All Things Digital was from a couple years ago. I think it was like the D5 or the D6 conference, they had Steve Jobs and Bill Gates on the same at the same time. That by far is one of the best technology personality interviews I've ever watched. To see these two guys on stage, mind you, this was before the iPhone was released, so it was kind of just as Apple had been climbing out of a hole for 10 years, and this was just before they hit it really, really big. And it was just impressive to hear the play back and forth between these two giants of technology.
Yeah, if none of you listening have ever seen that, it's on YouTube, you know, in like 50 parts, but
yeah,
you can find it.
It's totally worth watching, though. I mean, if it's, you know... Skip a couple episodes of Chuck and watch this. I mean,
No.
I mean, I like Chuck just as much as the next nerd, but I mean, this interview is a pinnacle in technology interviews.
Okay, wait a second. Did you?
I've never seen Chuck.
Frank.
Wait, I missed that. What?
Frank has never seen Chuck.
Oh no.
Frank, that's strike number two. You might want to not talk for the rest of the episode.
That is true.
Okay, I'm going to make you talk anyways. But wanted to point... Okay.
I think we should talk more about Zuckerberg's interview, though, for sure.
I wanted to mention one thing about Steve Ballmer first.
Oh, okay.
Steve Ballmer's talk was basically on Microsoft in the mobile realm. And I just thought it was really interesting that he actually... You know, he admitted... what was his exact words? We missed a cycle. You know, talking about... Microsoft had Windows Mobile out for years and years and years on lots of devices, and then all of a sudden, bam, iPhone from Apple, best thing since sliced bread, and Microsoft has done nothing since then. So it was interesting that, you know, Steve Ballmer actually admitted, you know, as Microsoft, we missed a cycle. We let the iPhone jump us, and now we're going to try to come out with something to compete with that.
Yeah, I mean, they definitely missed a cycle. But I think everyone has jumped to the conclusion that Microsoft has somehow lost. These are, make no mistake, these are, you know, large corporations. They are giants in the industry. And even if they continued to make the mistakes they have in the mobile industry, it would take years to erode, number one, the market share they already still have. I think they still have something like a 10 share of the mobile OS market. It would be years until that would erode to nothing.
And even once the market share goes away, they still probably have a lot of cash in hand that they can put towards developing something new.
Oh yeah, I mean, and you can argue whether that is some sort of form of antitrust, but I mean, all these companies are all in different areas of the tech industry, and I definitely look for Microsoft to hit one out of the park soon. I mean, it's not that they're not capable. I mean, you can't look at Windows 7 and just not see the genius behind some of the changes they made to turn Vista into a really, really elegant OS.
Right. That was probably the hardest thing they've ever done.
Yeah. I mean, it Vista on its launch was pretty bad, but 7 has made up for it and more. And, I'm sure we could probably mince words over security issues and everything else, but when you're the 800-pound gorilla, 90% market share or higher, it's pretty hard not to be just attacked from all sides.
Yeah, what do you think, Frank, as far as, Windows Mobile? If they come out with something that is awesome, do you think you would buy a phone that would use the new Windows Mobile OS?
I think I'll be sticking with my $5 eBay phone.
Okay, hold on. So, for those of us in the room here, Ryan has a BlackBerry, I have an iPhone, Frank has a phone from about 50 years ago. What is it, a Motorola Razr, the first one?
It's Razr 3, V3M.
Oh, so the first one. Yeah. Yeah, it was weird. Motorola called it the V3, even though it was their first edition Razr, and then they came out with the Razr 2, which the commercial showed them, throwing it and it sticking in the wall because it was so thin and sharp. I had one of those. They were pretty thin and sharp. Cut myself on them.
I never understood the thin phone craze. Like, I was just talking to a friend today about the battery life on some smartphones, and I don't know exactly how many milliamperes the battery is in the new in any iPhone.
Yeah, I don't think they even publish that. You might have to find a teardown to read the specs on the battery.
Right, but Apple's known for using different sized or shaped batteries to get higher yields in their milliamp ratings. I look at a lot of these cell phones, like even my BlackBerry, and it could easily be, a couple millimeters thick and I wouldn't notice. And they could totally fill that with lithium ion goo and just make the thing last probably twice as long as it does or longer. I don't know why they don't do it. Maybe right. The lithium ion stuff is expensive, but...
Yeah, that was one thing I found interesting with the iPhone 4, which we're going to talk about a little later, but they actually did just that. All of the extra space is battery. If you open up the phone, 90% of it is battery. But mm-hmm. I'm not going to mention any more of that. So last thing I wanted to talk about on the D conference, D8, is the biggest thing, if you're in the tech industry, the funniest thing. I mean, it was hilarious to watch. Actually, it wasn't so much hilarious. It was awkward, and you felt like you wanted to crawl up in a corner and not look at anybody while it was happening. But Mark Zuckerberg, the CEO of Facebook, the man that everybody in Silicon Valley hates, got interviewed, and he basically had a panic attack during the interview. He couldn't...
I don't know about you. I found it actually kind of satisfying.
Afterwards, I thought it was satisfying. I'm like, oh, this is awesome. But while I was watching it, I couldn't help but put myself in his place and feel horrible. Like, he must have... I don't know what he was thinking.
Well, I mean, I guess it's kind of a school hard knocks type of thing. He's a young guy. He's got a lot.
He's 26. He's my age.
Yeah, and I think when you run into success like that at an early age, you've got to mature really quickly. And we'll see what lies ahead. We talked about Facebook last week, but I really think that he's probably learned a few lessons from that experience.
Yeah, I mean, wow. He didn't really answer any questions. They asked him very specific questions, and he kind of, you know, answered every question with, well, you know, Facebook just started out as a thing in, you know, our college dorm room, so blah, blah, blah. You know, he never gave a straight answer. And then it was kind of funny that, you know, Kara Swisher being, you know, the mom on the stage, you know, so you're sweating, take off your hoodie. And she basically made him take off his hoodie and give it to her. And then there was the Illuminati insignia inside of the hoodie.
Yeah. A couple of these hoodies, I guess, have shown turned up on eBay now, too.
They're going for thousands of dollars.
Yeah, I wouldn't pay $1,000 for anything Facebook sells.
Yeah, basically, it looked just like a black hoodie, you know, a zip-up hoodie from the outside. But whenever you look on the inside of it, it was all shiny blue, and there was this big Facebook logo, like 2010, openness, connectedness. It was like their, you know, motto for 2010. But I guess he really didn't want people to see that, but since he was having a panic attack and about to pass out, they made him take off his coat. But if you haven't seen that, you know, just do a Google search for D8 or the D conference, go to their webpage and watch Mark Zuckerberg's interview. So, Frank, I know you don't use Facebook, or do you, and we just don't know your profile?
No.
Okay, so you don't use Facebook. I'm sure you've heard about all the privacy problems. So, not being a user of Facebook, what do you think? You know, just give it your general opinion about all this crap that's happening. No opinion?
Trying not to have one.
Okay, that was useful. So, we talked all we wanted to talk about the DA conference. So, last two things, going to be talking more about mobile. So, in the past couple years, one could not help but notice that RIM, Research in Motion, the makers of the BlackBerry device, haven't really come out with anything groundbreaking. You know, they've come out with touch devices, they've come out with things that are very similar to the iPhone, but they haven't done anything like, you know, Apple did coming out with the iPhone. Nothing really groundbreaking. And you're seeing a lot of people moving towards iPhones, you're seeing a lot of people moving toward Android devices now that Google has a mobile operating system and they're advertising the crap out of it on TV. So we just wanted to talk a little bit about what do you guys think as far as RIM goes? You know, what's their future look like? Do you think they're going to come out with, you know, a home run, or do you think they're going to slowly dwindle down and kind of lose out to Apple and Google on this?
Well, one place that they've really failed to keep up, and I think everyone knows this, you know, if they've used the Storm, is the touchscreen technology. The short press technology was neat, but not well executed. So I think they have a lot of catching up to do there. As far as the applications go and in their, you know, environment, I think they're on par with Apple in that respect. You know, they have the App World. I have a BlackBerry. It's easy to purchase apps from it. They're small, they're efficient. They all, everything I've used works pretty well. the thing that I think they have an advantage on in is security. RIM has designed a fortress of an OS, mobile OS, that I think in the future is going to pay off for them as things like privacy and security become more of a popular concern with the average Joe. So if they play their cards right, marketing the devices they sell in that manner, they could have a real advantage over some of the other players.
What do you think, Frank? I know you've had some hands-on with mobile devices, you know, in your job. Have you used BlackBerries enough to?
Not much with the more recent ones. The older BlackBerries with the thumb wheel on the side, not color screens. That's the vintage I was working with. I would say, yeah, they're not dead yet, and I really can't predict if they'll pull something out or not. They're certainly capable of it. And
yeah, I mean, they've been around for a while. You know, whenever, go back 4 years, you know, go back to the year before the iPhone came out. If you mentioned smartphone, the first thing people said was BlackBerry. You know, yep. RIM and BlackBerry, they were the company. They started the whole craze as far as, you know, enterprise email on your phone goes. You know, they started the whole thing. So, I don't know. I kind of think them and Microsoft, you know, in the terms of skipping a cycle, I think they're trying to... this is purely my opinion, but I think they are doing what Apple did to start out with. You know, Apple didn't have a phone, so they were able to watch everybody, see what everybody else is doing, be able to think of stuff that nobody else is doing, and then bam, slam it on the public. Here's our new awesome device. I think that might be what Microsoft and RIM are doing. You know, they haven't released anything really cool, but they're watching everything, and they're making something really cool in the background, and in a year or two, we're going to see something awesome from one of the two.
Yeah, well, I mean, an example of this, you know, just some of your thoughts are on Apple. This is in some ways similar with, like, you know, redesigning the architecture of a system. Probably about 5-6 years ago, maybe longer, Microsoft started an initiative called the Trusted Computing Platform Alliance. And a lot of people were really afraid of that when it first started because they thought it was going to turn into everything's DRM, and for those of you, digital rights management, like, you know, this is where files are encrypted in such a way that only the owner can use the file, and the content owners can make things expire. But the bigger part of this was that the trusted computing platform allowed for things like encryption to be widely available to systems, and now this stuff's just part of the architecture of the Windows and Intel platform. And I'm getting to a point here, and the point is that a big leap that Apple made a couple years ago was to switch to Intel processors, and I believe this was one of the reasons, because they saw that they needed to have this ability in their hardware, and rather than design their own core platform, they went with the Intel one. That said, I think that maybe some of the similar things are happening now in Microsoft's mobile arena and with RIM, that they may be re-architecting some of the architecture, and they'll take another giant leap. Because one thing we have to remember here is, you know, Microsoft basically started this smartphone market. They didn't make it big. They didn't make it like a craze. They weren't, you know, pushing corporate email and texting on the platform. But it was them and really Palm that sort of pushed that early on. And the devices they have now are really just evolutions of those first gen devices. RIM's been around a long time, but I think their more recent phones actually were similar to the iPhone in that they were able to sit back and watch what the other guys were doing and make something even better. And Apple all along watched everybody, like you said. But my guess is that I think RIM will probably branch out into the consumer world even more. And I'm sure they've got a lot of good things on the horizon. If they don't, you know, then they're going to be in trouble. I think Microsoft is probably the most dangerous company out there right now in the mobile field. They really have the capital and the wherewithal to really do it right.
Right, and what a lot of people don't realize is that, you know, their platform is very similar to the desktop Windows platform. So if you have a coder who can code for Windows, you know, it's not going to take them more than 5 minutes to learn how to code for mobile Windows.
Yeah.
So you already have a developer base.
Yeah, there's some advantages there. I think the biggest advantage is that if you buy a copy of Visual Studio, it natively supports Windows Mobile application development. You know, and there's probably a lot of people out there don't even know that Windows phones, you can buy applications for them and download applications. That's a huge advantage for developers, is the familiarity with the tools, not just even the language or the architecture, but the tools themselves.
Right, knowing that you have that in Visual Studio automatically by default.
Yeah, that's a big deal. So I think where Microsoft has, you know, the back end for Windows Mobile, the actual core is based on Windows CE. Windows CE is no slouch. You know, that's an OS that's used in all kinds of things, medical equipment. It's used in
the Sheets touchscreens that you place your orders on.
Oh, there you go. It's used in, you know, like there's a company by the name of Tektronix that makes digital oscilloscopes and spectrum analyzers. Most of those run on a Windows CE platform nowadays. So that, you know, Windows CE is a very powerful operating system. I think once they tune it for low power devices, that was one of its bigger problems. You know, and then really add the layers that it was missing before, like the multi-touch interface, which Windows Mobile 7 promises, and some of those other, you know, mobile-esque features that really just they're just newer use cases that haven't really been exploited until the iPhone and the BlackBerry, you know, came out.
What do you think, Frank? Any ideas on RIM or Microsoft and their mobile OS, and, you know, any last thoughts before we move on from this?
I don't think I have anything to add that I haven't already said.
So one last thing I just wanted to mention, you know, before we get into talking about WWDC and the Apple stuff, is that as far as the other companies go, I really think the other companies need their own Steve Jobs. Like, in terms of, he doesn't care about the hardware that's in a device. He doesn't care about the technical specs. He cares solely about the user experience. If you can get something that works flawlessly with a, you know, half megahertz processor, he doesn't care. As long as it works amazing and he can demo it and it's awesome and people are going to buy it. So I don't know. I mean, maybe the other companies do have somebody like this, but it seems like they don't. Just from the products that Microsoft and Black RIM have been releasing, it seems like they don't have somebody whose sole purpose is user experience and what people are going to think. So I really think that's where these two companies, if they can get somebody with that type of vision, they can really, you know, come ahead and crush Apple and, you know, really have some competition there.
Yeah, Microsoft's made a couple good moves recently. They, I don't know. No one really knows if they made the moves or if these were personal decisions on the part of the employees. But the two of their, you know, head designers or I guess maybe they're just executives. I'm not even sure their names. But they're part of their, their mobile devices and their other projects, things outside of the desktop software arena, just stepped down recently. There's room for improvement there now. I think whoever takes over that role is now supposedly going to report directly to Steve Ballmer.
Well, if you remember from the Steve Ballmer interview, he actually said that the person who was over the mobile space, you know, is going to retire, mm-hmm. and he's not filling that space.
He's not.
Yeah, those people who were under this guy who's going to retire will now report directly to Steve, and Steve now basically has control over the mobile arena in Microsoft.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and he's, you know, I don't know how much of the execution of the Windows 7 revamp and launch Ballmer had to do with, but if he had anything to do with it, it's evident that he knows what he's doing. I don't think anyone can look at Windows 7 and not think that it's an excellent product. If a company can execute that well, then I expect that, you know, they could do it in any part of the tech field.
Right. If they can do it on the desktop, they can do it on a phone.
Yeah.
Okay, so last topic of the day, the most important one, near and dear to my heart. You know, maybe not so much for the other people, but WWDC, the Worldwide Developers Conference, Apple's big dev conference of the year, just happened, is still happening, I believe. But every year at about this time, we can expect a big release from Apple. For the past couple of years, that big release has been a new iPhone. And this year, Steve didn't disappoint. Talking about Steve Jobs now, not Steve Ballmer. Too many Steves. But he didn't disappoint. And for those of you who look at Gizmodo, you've probably seen the iPhone that was found in a bar left by one of the Apple engineers. You know, the teardown of it. Everybody thought, oh, is this real? Is this fake? Well, it turned out to be 100% exactly the iPhone that they released. It was yesterday, right? Yeah, yesterday, the keynote. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the one that, you know, Gizmodo paid $5,000 for is exactly the new iPhone. And it does come with a bunch of awesome specs. So I just want to read off a couple of them, the ones that I thought were pretty important, and then we can, you know, talk about this. So one big one is that it's not 4G. It's not the new generation of cell networks. You know, there are, really aren't any phones out there that are right now. But it does have HSDPA 7.2 megabits. So this is a new iteration. I don't want to say new. It's the next iteration of the 3G network. So right now, if you have an iPhone or any other, you know, Android, BlackBerry that uses 3G, your download speed is a little over 3 megabits a second. So very close to probably your home download speed. But HSDPA bumps it up to 7.2 megabits. You know, around here in Johnstown, probably not going to see that for another 20 years. No, maybe next year. But bigger cities, you can guarantee you're going to get that 7.2 megabit speed very soon. A couple other interesting things. Apple's own A4 processor. You know, they're no longer going to a third party. You know, not Intel, not AMD. They make their own processors now. The screen has double the resolution, 800 to 1 contrast ratio, and 326 pixels per inch, which basically means that everything will look as smooth as if you have a printed piece of paper in front of you. You know, if you've ever gotten up close to your LCD monitor and looked, you can see the pixels. You can see how everything is blocky. And what they're saying, that with the 3-inch screen that the iPhone has at 326 ppi, everything looks perfectly smooth. You can't tell that it's blocky anymore. So we'll see. Has a 5-megapixel camera, LED flash, everybody's been waiting for that, 720p video. And the cool thing that I like is that the price isn't higher than what the old ones were when they came out. $199 for the 16 gig, $299 for the 32 gig. You can pre-order them on June 15th and they come out on the 24th. So within 2 weeks, if you want one, you're going to have one. So what do you guys think about, you know, the new iPhone, everything you've seen so far? Do you think it's a game changer, or do you think it's just a good upgrade?
Well, I think there's a lot of interesting, you know, interesting things about the iPhone 4 release. Most of them I don't think are interesting in a way that others might find them interesting. In the keynote, Jobs talked about 8 major features that the new phone had. And a lot of these, I've been using this phrase quite a bit lately, but it's all about selling the sizzle and not the steak.
Steve is great at sizzle.
Yeah. I think that if Apple is nothing else, they are probably one of the best advertising companies in the world.
They should sell that service to other people.
They probably, you know, it's funny. I remember, you know, reading an article from John C. Dvorak probably about 15 years ago, 10 years ago, somewhere right around the time Apple was just flailing. And he said, you know, Apple should just start making computers that come in like zebra cases and you know, with panther paint on them and all these, you know, wild looking like fuzzy mice and all types of things that would just attract, because they're so good at like at ergonomics and design that he thought they should just go that route. And that's what they did. They focused on that throughout the late 90s and 2000s and on to today. I think they're to the point now where they may want to focus on advertising, because they're king of the hill in terms of the mobile market right now when it comes to design. I wouldn't say they're king of the hill in all aspects. When it comes to design, they're definitely, you know, king of the hill. But that could change quickly for them. So they should definitely keep their eyes out on different markets, because they can't remain king forever. But the features that he listed, what I found interesting about them is that they were sold as features to the user, but in many ways they're really features for Apple. A perfect example is the design. He listed that was his number one feature for everyone else. The fact that it uses this acrylic glass enclosure,
30 times harder than plastic.
Yeah, and that it uses the metal, the stainless steel metal band that's also an antenna.
That was a really cool feature.
Well, he sold you, but really what this feature is about is reducing the number of parts in the phone. Apple, you know, is trying to reduce their cost on these phones. They want to increase their margin on their sales. And yeah, they're going after volume, but the one thing that they'll probably soon realize is while there's a lot of market out there, they're going to run up against a wall in the price categories that they've been playing. Now in the United States, and I think probably a lot of countries, you know, with the subsidized phone plans, it's not that bad. And the iPad is pretty impressive pricing in a lot of instances, but I think if you look at the margin on, I guarantee the margin on the 3G enabled iPad is much higher because the cost is much higher, and that part is probably only a couple dollars in the grand scheme of things. And you know they designed it to include that, so the cost of pulling it out was right. Factored in.
There's just an empty space in the non-3G version.
Right, exactly. So my point is that, you know, they're selling this design as a feature for the user, but really it's about reducing the number of parts, you know, reducing the size of it. That there's less material in it. If they don't have to spend as much money on the actual crap that makes up the phone, like the plastic, the glass, whatever's in it, it's less cost to them, and they're still selling the things at the same price. So, you know, in the end, they're just trying to increase their margin.
Yeah, I agree with you 99.9%, but the metal rim, I still think is awesome, just for the fact that the antenna in the current iPhones, super small, and Apple has kind of taken responsibility, or they haven't taken responsibility, they haven't said this, but everybody's pretty much figured out that a lot of the problems with iPhones dropping calls, probably not AT&T's fault. It's probably the fact that the antenna in the iPhone is really small and it doesn't work well. So I think that you're right for most parts, you know, less parts, making it cheaper. But I really think having that antenna being the whole way around the phone, being metal like that, you know, that's, what, 30 times the size of the current antenna? So I really think that is actually going to help people who have had drop calls, you know. They may have figured out what the problem was and fixed it.
Yeah,
you're going to spend your next 2 weeks running around Johnstown making note of how your signal is so you can get the new phone, you can compare it, see how much of that antenna
definitely
makes a difference.
And then I'm going to submit a report to Apple and request money back whenever it doesn't work. And
yeah, but, I mean, it's you got a good point there. You know, it could very well be that antenna in the iPhone 3GS just doesn't cut it in the previous iPhones. And in this new one, it may. That's a very good point, and you know, time will tell. But I really think though that, you know, the intent is to reduce the cost on this. But it's not so much that I have a problem with that. I don't have a problem with a company increasing its margin. Yeah. What I have a problem with is advertising that as a feature. It's like, hey, guess what? We're making more money off your purchase. It's like, that's a feature for you.
Yeah, and especially at a conference that was for developers. Like, everybody who goes to this conference is tech savvy. They know the crap. So you don't have to give them the Macworld keynote, you know, that's dumbed down for the general person. If you tell somebody, yeah, we're including HSDPA 7.2 megabits in this thing, everybody's going to freak out because they all know exactly what that is. So yeah, I think his keynote could have been a little more technical. He didn't have to go the dumbed down route that he did.
Yeah. The other thing, you know, that's interesting is the A4 processor. They're selling this as a feature to the user. Again, this is a cost-cutting measure for Apple. Now, in part, it's deceiving in two ways. One, that it's sold as a feature. And yeah, it uses less power so that you can get more battery, I guess. But this is so that they don't have to put a bigger battery in it or have to deal with a, you know, crappy battery performance.
And I wonder if the only reason that they said it is because all the Android phones are saying 1 gigahertz Snapdragon processor. You know, I wonder if they're saying, oh, well, we have this processor just because everybody else is saying, oh, we have that processor.
It might be. The thing that was deceiving in the second part about the A4 is that they call it Apple Silicon. And Apple has designed aspects of that processor. But that processor is a Cortex, is an ARM A8 Cortex, and it's built by Samsung. It's designed by ARM. And Apple made modifications to it. And contracted Samsung to make the chip for them. It's really no different than them, you know, contracting Intel to build the processors for their MacBook Pros.
It's really no different to, you know, what any of our companies that we work for do work. You know, we have subcontractors, but yeah. whenever the product comes out, it's under our name, right. as if we did everything.
Yeah, I mean, they may have a right to do that because they've added the certain features, and I think a lot of it had to do with the power usage of the chip. But, you know, for them, I think it's kind of a slight in Samsung's in ARM's direction that, oh, it's all Apple, you know, and again, it's sold as a feature to the user, and I really don't think it's a feature for the user.
Yeah, there a lot of his 8 quote unquote things really weren't features.
Yeah.
What do you think, Frank? Anything jump out at you on the feature list of the new iPhone?
What were the other? How many did we go through? 2. What were the other 6?
Well, I have them. I actually have them listed here.
Yeah, go through them.
The other three after, or the other ones after that, were the high resolution display, the Retina display, the gyroscope that they added, the new camera system, the forward facing camera, which is probably the biggest revolution there. Is at least for users, iOS.
Yeah, they're calling it iOS, which is funny because they actually had to pay Cisco a hefty sum of money
right.
so that they could use the iOS name because Cisco has called their operating system for switches and routers iOS since the beginning of time.
An interesting note is they had to pay Cisco for the iPhone name. Cisco owned the iPhone name too.
I did not know that. That's
yeah,
pretty funny.
So, anyways, iOS 4, iBooks, and iAds. So those were 8 features.
Yeah. So what do you think, Frank? Any of those catch your eye or ear?
Yeah, not particularly. the resolution of the screen is very nice. Camera doesn't mean much to me because I'm not really into a bunch of picture taking or anything like that.
Not even the forward facing camera. You don't want to video chat with me? I mean, come on. Who doesn't want to see this face?
I can think of a
We're all
few.
Raising our hands, folks.
I'm going to leave now. Yeah, I think the gyroscope was pretty cool. You know, that adds... Basically, if you've ever seen the PS3 commercials and they say, you know, oh, we have 6-axis controller, which means that you can use the controller and rotate it, you know, pitch, roll, and yaw, and 3 more axes that I don't even know if they exist. But now the iPhone can, you know, do the same thing. So it's probably going to be used for, like, games a lot.
Yeah, I mean, the gyroscope's going to be pretty much limited to, you know, for most applications, it's going to be limited to gaming. You know, it definitely gives the user more control, but and I don't know how much it's of a wide-ranging feature it really is.
Yeah, I think it did just what the Wii HD Motion did, you know, the add-on to the Wiimote. The Wiimote was kind of good, but the HD Motion really, like, tracks where you're at. You know, it's perfect. So I think this is just Apple's way of doing that. I cut you off, Frank.
Yeah, personally, what I really want in a phone screen is to be able to, like, see it outside. I don't get that in my current phone either, but that's what I really want.
Yeah, and that's Apple failed on the iPad as far as that goes. You know, you take an iPad outside in sunlight, you're not reading it.
So, well, it's an LED backlit as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
And this new the Retina display that's on the iPhone, I don't know if there's anything to allow it to be seen outside. Is it?
They're saying that you can.
Okay.
I don't think they said why, or if they did, I didn't catch it.
Yeah.
But you're supposed to be able to, so we'll see.
The one thing I want
to... Or not.
Or not.
Or not, yeah. The one other thing I want to touch on with that Retina display is they're touting this resolution as a feature as well. And, yeah, it's nice that it has a lot of resolution.
You're not going to notice.
But, well, I mean, they sell it, and this is, again, it's another example of selling the sizzle, not the steak. They sell it as, oh, it's more lines of resolution than the Retina can distinguish. Well, if it's more lines than the Retina can distinguish, does it really matter? Like, the extra lines don't matter. But the claim that it's that the Retina can perceive 300 pixels per inch is a bit misleading, in my opinion. That depends on distance. You know, if you, like, take your 3D or your HDTV, for example, if you're sitting at a distance of 10 feet from a 40-inch screen, and you measure the field of view like in inches from your eye, it's not very big. It's in your field of view. It's maybe an inch and a half. So the pixel density is way higher than the iPhone's screen in terms of your field of view. Now, so I just think that distance plays a big part in that number. It's brilliant marketing, I guess, but it's a little bit, misleading, I think.
Yeah, and I think it was also just kind of a catch-up to the Android phones, because they have always had, resolutions this big.
Yeah.
So in a way, people looked at the iPhone and said, that's just half the size of the screen. Why do we want that?
Yeah, but with the Android, I think the current, the Incredible and the Nexus One are like 800 by 480.
Yeah, the new iPhone is like 100 pixels bigger. Yeah,
so they're comparable. It's great. High resolution display is great, but I've mentioned this before to friends. Everybody talks about having an HTML5 compliant browser on their iPhone or on their Android or whatever, and they talk about how it's awesome that it renders the web pages the same way it does on the desktop. I think it's like trying to use a wrench to hammer in a nail in some ways. I don't want the same user interface on my phone that I have on my desktop. Like, because, A, the desktop interface isn't designed to be as productive on a touchscreen. I always give the example of the mobile website for CNNS, Sports Illustrated?
Yeah, CNNSI.
Yeah, and if you go to that website, just do it. If you have a smartphone, go to the website. It's m.cnnsi.com. And just, it's not real extravagant. It's simple, but you can find the scores of the games you want to find. You don't have to zoom in. You don't have to do any kind of scrolling. It's just you just go to the link on the top of the page for NFL, NBA, college basketball, whatever you want. And I guess my point is that the pixels on these screens are less of a concern as the design of the interface. And I think this is the reason that apps are so popular on the iPhone and that browsing is not. If web designers would pay more attention to that, they could pull in a lot more traffic, I think, and open up the market to the other browsers that are out there. Even though they're not great at HTML5 and they're not great at the desktop experience, they could be great at a mobile version of the website.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. If you look at any applications on the iPhone, the buttons are absolutely huge.
Yeah.
They're designed with a person's thumb or index finger in mind,
yeah,
whereas normal websites are not.
The user interface should match the interface you're using.
Frank, that is genius. Please tell me you made that up.
Just now.
That is awesome. You heard it here first, folks.
Words of wisdom.
So the last thing I wanted to mention about the iPhone, which I don't know who to thank. I don't want to thank AT&T because I hate them, but I'm going to thank Steve Jobs on this one. But that all current iPhone users can get the iPhone 4 no matter where they're at in their contract. They mentioned at the keynote that if you are over a year in your contract, you can get it for the upgrade pricing. I am not over a year in my contract, but I did the, *639# text message to see, what my upgrade availability was. And it told me that I can upgrade for the upgrade price, and I only have to pay an $18 upgrade fee. So that is amazing. That's awesome for me.
Part of me was wondering if maybe that was part of the trade-off, let people upgrade early versus dropping that unlimited plan for the iPad, if that was part of the deal in the back rooms there.
Yeah, that's...
Who knows? I don't...
Yeah, what do you guys think about that? That they got rid of the unlimited data plan, and now you have a choice of a 250 megabyte plan, which you can use over lunch, or the 2 gigabyte plan?
Well, I think this isn't just for the iPad. It's for all AT&T smartphone devices.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah,
including the iPhone. Because right now, iPhone users...
New iPhones.
Right. But yeah, the current iPhone users are unlimited, right?
Yeah, the current iPhone users get grandfathered in. They can keep their unlimited data plan for $30 a month.
But I can guarantee you when you get that new iPhone 4 that you're gonna switch to probably a 2 gigabyte plan.
No. Some person said that they would try to trick you. So you're probably going to have to go in and say, remember to keep my unlimited plan, or else they might do it. But yeah, you can keep it.
Oh, well, that's good, I guess. But as far as like what I think about the plan, though, I saw, and there's an infographic out there on Dig about what 2 gigabytes get you and what 200 megabytes get you, and I think it's a non-issue. Like I know people really want unlimited access on their phones, but I just don't think that the devices themselves have the bandwidth, not the download bandwidth, the display bandwidth, the processing bandwidth,
the interface to your brain bandwidth.
Yeah, you just can't do that much on these phones. You know, no one's downloading like ISOs of Linux onto their iPhones.
Frank would if he could.
Well, the normal person is not down. No, I'm sorry. I think that, you know, based on what I saw in that infographic, you know, it's just like a non-issue to me. I've had an unlimited plan on Verizon for as long as I've had a smartphone, and I think the most I've ever used in 1 month was like maybe 170 or 190 meg. So
I overheard a conversation today where I think he said that he has been using just over a gig and his wife just under a gig on their phones.
Yeah, I really haven't come close. I've been in the 600 to 800 megabyte range every month. This month, I'm approaching a gig. Oh, I just sent the text message and got it back. As of right now, I'm at 1.2 gigabytes. So I don't know what I've been doing. I've been listening to, you know, Twit live streaming.
Yeah. And well, yeah. I mean, there's certain things I don't do any type of... Well, I do a little bit of streaming from, like, Slacker and Pandora, but, you know, nothing major.
Yeah, that's the big thing. I forget whether it was AT&T or Apple, but one of their sites had a nice little calculator with some sliders, and it basically said, you know, how many times a week or a month do you do these things? And it had categories like checking email, uploading pictures to Facebook, streaming music. And you move the slider to say how many times you did this, and it would tell you the approximate amount of data that you use. Well, for me, and for some people that I work with, you know, we listen to Pandora or other streaming audio on our phones during work. You know, that's how we get our entertainment, because a lot of that stuff is blocked on the network at work, so we have to use our phones. So just doing that 4 hours a day every day, you are well over 2 gigabytes. Like, the slider didn't even go up that high. It just maxed out at red. So I think you're right. For most people, not going to see. It's going to be a non-issue. But for those people who do like to listen to streaming music that is not on their iPod or on their device, they could get screwed and have to pay a lot of money.
The one argument against the size caps that was kind of compelling to me is if you go back through the past and say, well, what if, you know, X years ago when we were using modems, it was capped at this much, or when we first got cable modems, it was capped at this much, that we've way past those now, would we have been able to see the innovation we've seen on the internet if people were trying to restrict their usage to avoid going over these caps?
That is true. Another example I heard recently was, and I think this might have been at the D8 conference, is that they're restricting their revenue, or, you know, their ad revenue. The less you're on the phone browsing, the less ad revenue you're going to generate.
The less eyes on the ads, the less dollars.
Right. Which on a sidetrack is another thing that, you know, Steve Jobs listed as a feature that's not a feature.
iAds.
iAds is not a feature. That's just another way to, like, pop up ads at you.
Which I hate, by the way. If I can find a way to install Adblock on my iPhone, I will do it right now. But speaking of Adblock, I didn't put this on the list of topics to talk about, but I just saw that Safari 5 was released, and it has an extension API. So do either of you use Safari on a regular basis?
I haven't. Not since Chrome came out.
Frank?
When I'm at home, I use it. I do have installed on my Safari 4 a ad block for Safari, but you have to run in 32-bit mode. But
yeah, that's
and it doesn't work as well as what Firefox seems to.
Yeah, that's the one thing keeping me from using Safari. I want so badly to use Safari because it's WebKit. It's pretty much the only browser that does perfect in the ACID 3 test. So I want so much to use Safari, but the lack of extensions, basically the lack of Adblock, is what's keeping me from it. That I can't have a working version of Adblock. I can't have my delicious bookmarks integrated into the pull-down bookmarks. And there are some other random extensions that I like to have, but now that Safari is coming with an extensions API, I think it's going to open up just like, you know, Firefox did, and you're going to see a lot of extensions, and people are going to start using that, or at least developers, because I don't think the normal user knows, unless you're a Mac user and it's your default browser, I don't think the normal Windows user even knows Safari is there.
Do either of you have any idea if there was any note of compatibility between their extensions API and like Chrome's API? I think Mozilla was working on a kind of a Chrome-compatible extension API from one of their experimental versions.
I don't know.
Yeah, I have no clue. That would be awesome, though, if by making an extension API, what they really mean is you can program in this one way and it's going to work on Chrome, Safari, and Firefox. That would be cool.
Yeah. I have mixed feelings about the ad blocker software. You know,
I don't. Ads are the devil.
Well, you know, one of the things that, you know, Steve Jobs talked about and at the DA conference was printed media. Well, actually, Kara Swisher asked him about it and how the iPad might be the savior of printed media. You know, I like reading the newspaper, at least some of it. And, you know, you have to have a good filter with anything you read. But I still like to read it. And, you know, if you want good journalism, you got to pay for it. And the 75 cents or whatever they charge for a copy of the paper doesn't buy you good journalism. It's the advertising in the paper that buys the journalism. And in some ways, you know, advertising can be very powerful because it lets you know about things you may not have known about. If Apple sucked at advertising, no one would buy their products, you know. And if you didn't see their ads on TV and they weren't able to create this image, you know, you wouldn't feel that emotional connection that they always talk about with Apple products.
Hi, I'm a Mac.
Yeah, you know, so I have mixed feelings. Like, I could actually see Steve Jobs prohibiting any ad blocker extensions in his browser. I wouldn't doubt that he would enable something like that. And in some ways, I got to give him a little bit of credit in that arena because, you know, we want, but we don't want to pay for the things that we use. And I love the advertising model. I love having unlimited internet, essentially, at home because all of the content that I look at is paid for through advertising. That way I don't have a bill that's twice as much as it is. You know, I think people really underestimate the amount of work that goes into creating the content on the web, the good content. Cause I can tell you right now, you know, there's a lot of people that don't create content cause they can't, it takes up too much of their time and they don't get paid for it.
Right. The price for entry is way too high.
Yeah, it can be. You know, so it's just something to think about.
Yeah, I mean, my two points against that, you know, I don't mind paying for things, you know, so if there's...
Of course not, you buy Apple products.
Exactly, the Apple tax. So, you know, if there's two applications, one is a free version with ads and one is a, you know, $2 or $3 version without ads, I will gladly pay $2 or $3 to get something without ads. You know, I'm not the person who just runs ad blockers, doesn't see ads, and never pays for anything. I'll pay for that. But on the other hand, I use ad blockers because I don't want to see the way most of the ads are designed. Like Google ads, the text ads, no problem. I have no problem with those on a web page. But when I start seeing animated things, and you would think, you know, it's 2010, why do we still have animated ads, banner ads on pages? But we do. And I go to websites on machines without ad block, and I see these animated banners and these bright flashy things.
Punch the monkey.
Punch the monkey. I don't want to punch the monkey. But I mean, really, like, if you have a web page that has, you know, really neutral colors, whites and grays and blacks, and then along the side there's this bright red and purple banner ad, that annoys the crap out of me. Those are what I don't want to see. If you can advertise to me in a way that doesn't distract me from the web page, fine.
Oh, I totally agree with you. I mean, I've been arguing about this with other people about TV ads for years. I don't actually know that anyone argues back. But the point is, like... Like, look at Super Bowl Sunday. People, all they talk about, if you're not a fan of the team, one of the teams in the Super Bowl,
nobody cares about the game.
Yeah, the water cooler the next day, you know, you're talking about the advertisements, and it's like, make a good advertisement. Make something that entertains me, and I'll watch your damn advertisement. You know? Oh, no, now we're going to get the explicit tag.
Oh, 18 plus.
Dang it. But anyway, I really mean it. You know, there's ads out there that are just freaking hilarious. Like, I'm not – this may seem weird, but that Kia Soul commercial with the hamsters driving it, it's funny. I mean, it's – you know, I get a little chuckle every time I watch it. There's a lot of commercials out there like that, and you know, there's a lot that aren't, probably even more that aren't, and it's just like local advertising is one of the worst. But, you know, I think you're right. If they could make ads that were awesome all the time, no one would block them.
Right.
You know, I would gladly watch them on my DVR.
Yeah, what do you think, Frank? Any strong opinions for ads?
Pretty much what just been said here. The ads that are, you know, entertaining, non-obtrusive, not obnoxious, are okay. Ads that are any of those evil things, not okay.
So you mentioned you have a form of ad blocker in Safari. Do you generally use an ad blocker program for that purpose because of those crappy ads?
Yeah, generally when I set up a new browser profile, I leave like any extensions out for a while, and then when I finally get annoyed at the obnoxiousness of some of the advertisements, then I go find AdBlock.
See, for me, that happens as soon as I open up a web browser, because my web browser defaults to my Google Reader feed, and for some reason, people thought that it was smart to start putting ads in RSS feeds. So in my Google Reader, I'm getting headlines and then a 400-pixel tall ad in my Slashdot feed. That is crap. You know, that's why I have AdBlock.
You know, speaking of ruining RSS feeds, I saw somebody complaining about Engadget and their coverage of the Worldwide Developer Conference, the Apple keynote, and that they had like 15 stories in, you know, attributed to the Apple keynote, which caused everyone's RSS feeds from Engadget to have 15 entries for this one story. And that was a bunch of crap, I think, but anyway.
Was it 15 like identical stories?
No. No. There's like, oh, the iPhone has an antenna that's part of the case. Oh, the iPhone 4 OS or iPhone 4 OS
so, like,
came out.
Their updates were new pages, quote unquote.
Yeah,
and
well,
generated a new title.
Yeah, each title is a new entry in the RSS feed, and every one of them was about the, you know, the Apple keynote.
That's kind of funny.
Yeah,
see, I mean, that doesn't happen with the Songcast.
Is it what's the guy's name from Engadget? Ben
Josh Topolsky?
No, there's Ben something. He's I think he works for Engadget HD. You know, he was interviewed, was listening to This Week in Tech at one point, and he had Ben Drawbaugh or something like that. You know, Leo had him on Twit, and he was interviewing him and asking him, you know, just about Apple and, you know, stuff like that. And he's like, we don't show pictures of the Engadget table at these conferences because it would be like 52, you know, MacBook Pros all over the table. These guys are Mac fanatics, which is fine, but it's like bias in journalism almost. It's very evident that you know, there's this bias there, and I think it's a little bit, there wasn't even, you know, today and yesterday was the opening of the Microsoft Tech Ed conference in New Orleans, of all places.
I had no idea that was going on.
Yeah, and they didn't cover it.
I think I'd seen, like, one headline, and they were speculating it was going to be completely buried by WWDC.
Yeah.
And that brings up another point. What genius scheduled that? Seriously, why would you do that? You know, if Apple had theirs booked first, as a Microsoft employee, why would you book the same week or the other way around? Or I guess I can see if it was the other way around, Apple knew they were going to crush Microsoft. So,
yeah, if you go back into the old PC and Mac days, there are a bunch of stories of Microsoft scheduling their events around Apple's events just to crush them at the time.
Maybe
so.
It's payback.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have any problem with Microsoft or with any either company, but, you know, I think in terms of journalistic integrity, which we all know the tech industry journalism is pretty rough. If anyone followed the iPad release when Jason Calacanis, you know, did his barrage of tweets about the features.
That was pretty funny.
Yeah. I mean, he upended the Wall Street Journal. He upended the New York Times blog, a bunch of other journalists in the tech industry all quoted him verbatim from a series of Twitter posts. You know, it was very evident that there's literally no journalistic integrity or even fact-finding. They didn't even bother to call him and say, hey, Jason, can you verify this for us?
Is this even real?
Yeah. So, I mean, maybe that's a little bit of a sidebar, but that bothered me a lot.
Yeah. And Jason is, I mean, a lot of people really don't know him unless you listen to the Twit podcast or read a lot about the tech industry. You know, he's a venture capitalist, so he's an angel investor in a lot of companies. So he's one of the rich guys that gives money to startups to get them started. And that's his job. He gives money to startups and helps get them started and invests in them, and that's how he makes money. When they go big, he makes money because he's an investor. So that's what he does. So he is pretty well respected in that regard. And yeah, these Twitter posts, I mean, some of the stuff he was saying, like, you know, the first iPad app that's going to be released is the Farmville app.
And it'll have an HD QAM tuner built in for, you know, cable
right.
TV.
Right, you can watch over-the-air HD TV on your iPad. I mean, some of this stuff was just, you knew there was no way this was coming in the iPad. And the Wall Street Journal and other places published it as if it was gospel truth.
Yeah. Granted, they only publish it on their websites, but it's like, well, maybe you're not making money because your website journalism sucks.
Yeah, why don't you go get some print people, have them work for the website, you know, show you how it's done a little bit. Okay, so that is everything that I wanted to talk about. Do you guys have anything else? Anything to add before we close out? Nothing?
No?
No, I don't think so.
Nope.
Oh, awesome. So that is it for this week's episode of the Slongcast. I want to thank Ryan and Frank for being here. We've got a full house. This is awesome. Hopefully every week I can keep two guests in here. So as always, you can find me on Facebook and Twitter. My username is Slongcack. You can find Ryan on Facebook and Twitter, username Ryan Lancey. And Frank, how do people get in contact with you? Because
generally I prefer that they don't.
Do you want to give out your Twitter? Do you care?
I don't care, but if it was me, I wouldn't.
Okay, so I will respect that. And if you want to get in contact with Frank, have your people call his people, and that's how it's going to work. So have a great night, everybody.